Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Come to the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. In beautiful Hyde Park, 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is where serious readers go for fun. Enjoy a wide selection of titles in a unique space that's perfect for browsing. Specialties include literature, mysteries, children's books, cookbooks, and travel. The Newberry Library Bookstore at 60 West Walton carries a distinctive selection of books, cards, and gifts in a beautiful landmark setting. Specialties include Native American studies, history, genealogy, cartography, calligraphy, and music. And the Seminary Co-op at 5757 South University Avenue, across from the University of Chicago Quad, enjoys a reputation as one of the best academic bookstores anywhere. Known for the breadth and depth of its inventory, the Co-op carries more than 100,000 titles in a wide range of disciplines. Visit the Seminary Co-op bookstores in person, call toll-free 800-777-1456, or look up semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Adam Gopnik, whose book, Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Welcome to Writers on the Record. You obviously have some fans here, Adam Gopnik. Thank you all for joining us today. I am Victoria Lautman, the host and executive producer. We are here on the set of Looking Glass Theater's new production of Argonautica, soon to open on Sunday, the new program with by Mary Zimmerman. And, of course, Clay is playing in the upstairs theater. This is a great moment for Looking Glass Theater. And we are, again, thrilled to have this season of Writers on the Record underwritten by the Maven Chronicles. Everybody, come on, give them a hand. Took us 2 years to find somebody to underwrite it, but we did, and they're fabulous. You've already heard the thanks to Chicago Magazine and to our partner WFMT Radio. So enough about that. We're here because of Adam Gopnik. And here's the thing about our guest today. In 1980, Adam Gopnik moved to Manhattan for the first of what, the first time. They moved within Manhattan two more times after that, he and his wife, Martha. And at the time, he was a graduate student in art history. But apparently, he had two burning ambitions. The first was to become a songwriter. The second was to work for The New Yorker. So obviously, one of these things is still on his to-do list. But the other one he did manage, and he's in fact been with The New Yorker now for going on 20 years as an essayist, as an art critic, as a contributor in a variety of ways. The jury's still out about his second ambition. Maybe we can explore that today. But when he moved to Paris in 1995 with his family for 5 years, writing the Paris Journal, and then subsequently collected a number of those with other essays into the fabulously best-selling book, Paris to the Moon. A lot of you have probably read that book. Then moved back to New York in 2000 with his family, which had been increased at that point by a new member, his daughter, Olivia, and began to write the New York Journal. The new book that he has published, which is Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York, is a compilation of a series of those essays, plus a lot of new material, too. A lot of you probably don't realize that he also, in the interstitial moment between these two books, wrote another book, The King in the Window, that came out in 2005, which was a book basically aimed at his son, Luke. It's a children's book, although to say that really kind of sort of undermines it. It's more like young adult. So anyway, the fact is we've got Adam here with us for the next hour, and what a pleasure to have him. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. it's always truly a pleasure to be in Chicago, a, a place that fascinates me and that I love and that I always and has my favorite museum in the world. So.
Oh, yay. We like to hear that. And now one of your favorite restaurants. Look, I was thinking about this trajectory of your career, and to have these two ambitions and then to pursue art history seemed a little circuitous to me. What made you decide you wanted to be a songwriter and work for The New Yorker and then to go into art history?
It seemed a lot circuitous to me, too. I wanted to be a songwriter, like sort of everyone of my generation.
Not like Tom Lehrer, but more like...
No, I wanted to be... I love rock music, and I loved the Beatles when I was a kid and a teenager, and I played in a band and all of that. And then one Sunday night, it was a very specific time, I read in The New Yorker, actually, S.N. Berman's diary. Sam Berman was a playwright in the 1930s, and he had a long section about the Gershwin brothers, about knowing George Gershwin. Absolutely fascinating. And it's a sign of what that time was like, that I genuinely did not know who Gershwin was. I had a vaguest kind of sense of him, because... You know, the cutoff between the 1960s and the music that preceded it was very great. Nowadays, you know, we look back at the Beatles. My 12-year-old adores the Beatles, and that was 40 years ago. But from 1970, music from 1930 was seemed very alien. And I went out the next morning, and I bought a record of Ella Fitzgerald singing Gershwin songs with the great Ellis Larkins at the piano. And I said, oh, my goodness, I never knew about this kind of music. And I became quite obsessive about it. Alec Wilder, a great songwriter, wrote a book called American Popular Song. That I also read. So I said, I'm going to be a songwriter like those guys. And I went to work, and I only played guitar, so that's which is not a natural instrument for that kind of music. Anyway, I wrote the college show, and I came to New York with a cassette of all my kind of Rodgers and Hart pastiche songs. And I took it around, and I thought, what I'll do is I'll just study art history until I break into Broadway. And that was really my ambition. And when you're 22 or 3, you think, oh, that makes perfect sense, of course. You know, I mean, you'll just be doing, you know, Botticelli studies, and meanwhile, you'll be pounding the pavement and going to the Brill Building and trying to sell your songs. And I did that for a bit, and I never... And then I got distracted, partly, as you know, because I had, in some sense, the misfortune to meet a truly great teacher.
Don't you start talking about him yet.
All right, no, I won't start... But I just mean that when you have a great teacher... I would have gotten out of art history much sooner. I still love, and I was always drawn to it because I love museum going. I love looking at pictures. I love talking about pictures. Like every academic discipline designed to support that, it ends up cannibalizing that emotion. And art history, in fact, is a very bad way to go if you love pictures.
Okay, but wait a minute, because you say that, but then I was thinking back, you must have had classes in what they, I don't even know if they teach this anymore, connoisseurship, mm-hmm. which is training the eye to be able to look at something and understand the minute details.
Well,
and
you know, actually, Victoria, no, because by the time I got into university, the model of art historical study, of scholarship, was what was called iconographic studies. That means figuring out what all the little symbols in a picture might mean. But, of course, they were very secondary to the effect a picture has on your mind and emotions, in fact. So we were put to work doing this kind of insanely picayune problem solving instead, in fact, of trying to understand why it is that these strange still colored pictures can have this enormous moral and emotional impact.
Well, I guess what I was trying to figure out is whether that was a good training, actually, for the type of writing. I'm trying to bring it back to the book here. the type of writing that you do, which is so focused and keenly observed, that the art history training you had, whether it was, you know, symbiology or iconography right. or any of that stuff, really does translate very well into your... you know, minutely observed pieces. And you could take a probably can of Alpo dog food and write brilliantly about it, you know, for 3 pages. And even just asking you one question today, like, gee, why did you do that? You know, here we get the history of music and the disconnect between this generation and that. And blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, obviously, this is the way you think, but the art history training seems to have really enhanced that.
Well, I studied with some great teachers who put a huge emphasis on close looking, and that was terrific. You know, though, it's actually funny because when you read my stuff, I think one of the things you'll see is, you know, John Updike, for instance, has always been a writer I've hugely admired. But Updike is a truly visual writer. He wanted to be a cartoonist. He wanted to be a draftsman. And everything he sees, whether it's the curl of pubic hair on a suburban housewife or the design of a of a Giotto, he sees in that way. The truth is what I do tends to be much more that I make metaphors and I make and I analyze. It's a little bit a different thing. I don't think I have a great gift for visual evocation on the page. I think I create the illusion of visual evocation because I do think I have a certain gift for a metaphoric image, for what the thing feels like when you look at it, which is a slightly different thing. So I'm essentially a charlatan of visual experiences expressed. If you read Updike stuff, for instance, you'll see somebody who really can directly translate visual experiences into writing, whereas I tend to mediate them more by metaphor.
Well, you do it well enough that you've faked us out. You faked me out anyway. I'd like you to start with a reading from the very beginning of Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York. And before you do that, it's really from the first two pages of the book. Maybe you can describe for us what this process was like and maybe compare it to Perish of the Moon. Did you always know that you were going to have this next book in you when you came back? Were you very much aware as you were writing New York Journal that these might be pieces that would end up in this book?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I haven't written a line since I was six, which I didn't visualize in 12-point type appearing eventually. And certainly once I'd done Paris the Moon, I knew that I would do New York on the ground eventually. So I did know that. What I didn't know, and it's the nature of the kind of work I do, is what would be salvageable or not. In other words, I was writing a lot of pieces for the magazine under the New York Journal rubric that were reporting pieces. And when I had a kind of notion in my head that I would do a lot of kind of very pointillist, impersonal reporting. And I did. But then when I went to put them in the book, and my original conception of the book would be that it would oscillate between these very impersonal kind of little anthropological pieces about the city, and then the comic essays, as I like to call them, comic sentimental essays. And then when I did that, Victoria, it didn't work. In other words, that the play, what I thought would be a play of public and private, just looked like it was two writers at war in the same book. In fact, it didn't flow in that way. And I realized that there was a certain kind of pressure in the personal essays, if for lack of a better word, the comic essays in this, that precisely because they really weren't comic. They were where the ones in Paris the Moon are really about happiness. I hope that they're not just happy, they're analyzing happiness, but essentially they're about happiness. And these were all much more three-dimensional in a certain way, much more, and a kind of chiaroscura, dark and light in them that the others didn't. But let me read you the very beginning of the book. In the fall of 2000, just back from Paris, with the sounds of its streets still singing in my ears and the codes to its courtyard still lining my pockets, I went downtown and met a man who was making a perfect map of New York. He worked for the city, and from a set of aerial photographs and underground schematics, he had turned every block, every highway, and every awning, every one in all five boroughs, into neatly marked and brightly colored geometric spaces laid out on countless squares. Buildings red, streets blue, open spaces white, the underground tunnels sketched in dotted lines. Everything in New York was on the map. Every ramp to the major Deegan Expressway and every abandoned brownstone in the Bronx. The kicker was that the maniacally perfect map was unfinished and even unfinishable because the city it described was too dynamic, changing every day in ways that superseded each morning's finished drawing. Each time he had put everything in place, the subway tunnels aligned with the streets, the Con Ed crawl spaces with the subway tunnels, someone or other would come back with the discouraging news that something had altered, invariably a lot. So every time he was nearly done, he had to start over. I keep a small section of that map in my office as a reminder of several New York truths. The first is that an actual map of New York recalls our inner map of the city. We can't make any kind of life in New York without composing a private map of it in our minds. And these inner maps are always detailed, always divided into local squares, and always unfinished. The private map turns out to be as provisional as the public one. Not one in which our walks and lessons trace grooves deepening over the years, but one in which no step, no thing seems to leave a trace. The map of the city we carried just 5 years ago hardly corresponds to the city we know today, while the New Yorks we knew before are buried completely. The first New York that I knew well, Soho's art world of 20 years ago, is no less vanished now than Carthage, the New York where my wife and I first set up housekeeping, the old Yorkville of German restaurants and sallow Eastern European families, is still more submerged, Atlantis, and the New York of our older friends, where the light came in from the river and people wore hats and on hot nights slept in Central Park, is not just lost, but by now essentially fictional, like Narnia. New York is a city of accommodations and of many maps. We constantly redraw them, whether we realize it or not, and are grateful if a single island we knew on the last survey is still to be found above water. Can I stop there?
You can stop there. Adam Gopnik, reading from his new book, Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York. Oh, come on, give him a hand.
I go on in that section then to describe my own first experience in New York. When I came to New York, and I was for the opening of the Guggenheim Museum, my parents were kind of culturally ambitious, and we drove up from Philadelphia, where I live, and it was amazing. Day in New York, we went and we had blintzes at a kosher restaurant and were insulted by the waiter. It was the best day I'd ever had. And then they put me to bed in the maid's room. My great aunt Hannah, who would later be the witness at our wedding, had a big apartment, as middle-class people did in those days in Riverside Drive. And I remember lying in the bed and looking out at the lights of the Palisades across the Hudson River in New Jersey. And I thought, oh, there's New York. I said, wow, that's such an amazing city. It's so amazing to be here. I'm going to get there someday. And I remember that so clearly. And there was some emotional sense in which New York is always someplace else. It's always a place we aspire to. It's never the place we've got. And I feel that to this day, even though I've lived in New York on and off for 25 years, I always think I will get to New York someday. And every time I see the skyline looming up as I come from LaGuardia or Kennedy after a trip, I think, this time I'll get New York. This time I'll get there. And of course, once you're there and you're living there, that imagery, that incredible magnet of hope that the skyline represents emotionally, dissolves necessarily into these little tiny islands of life that you actually inhabit. New York is a city, like Chicago, I suppose, of blocks. It's a city where your life is circumscribed by the dry cleaners and the supermarket, and where my son and I were once figuring out that we could actually do everything except buy men's clothes without having to cross more than one streetlight in our neighborhood. So the play between that amazing vision, which represents hope to the entire world, and that actual experience of three or four people in six or seven rooms is what structures the book.
You know, when I first read that, the first few pages of the book, and you do talk about going there and you're having this perfect day as a child, and it's your grandfather who was named after Ellis Island.
That's
and
right.
The word that kept popping into my mind, and then it came up over and over again all through this book, was just besotted. Which is not a word that I think about a lot, but I just thought, this is a person who is absolutely besotted with the city and besotted with his kids, who, of course, like the child raising, this is really about your family and moving them back and kind of rediscovering the city in a way that you couldn't have experienced before because you didn't have your children there. I mean, you know, Luke was born
just before you moved,
and Olivia was born right when you were coming back,
yeah.
And it seems to me that whatever, and this book is bracketed by loss and by, I mean, really terrible things. Obviously the biggest thing was 9/11 happened not long after you moved back. The loss of your best friend, your teacher that you were alluding to, Kirk Varnado, the godfather of Luke. There's loss, even the loss of Bluey, the pet goldfish, which is one of the most charming and funny essays. But in spite of that, the sheer joy of this city with this family seems to kind of ooze out of the entire book.
I hope so. Besotted, I think, is a good word, in fact, too. I hope I have a capacity for besottedness. And that one of the things that I do is romanticize experience. And I don't mean that, and I hope not in an entirely bad way, because I hope I also have a certain eye for the disillusion that necessarily comes after you romanticize a place, and that play between, I like liking things. I love New York. I love Paris. I believe in New York, as I say someplace in the book. But it's certainly true that that you couldn't be shallowly besotted by your experience in the last 5 years. And I wanted the book to be about the necessity of finding not just pleasure, but joy in shadow. Because, as you said, you know, New York's experience was in the long shadow of 9/11 in the last 5 years, and my own personal experience was in the smaller, but for me, lengthier shadow of watching your closest friend die of cancer. And nonetheless, not because I willed it, but because it is in the nature of life. If you've got two small children who are discovering the world, the one thing they can't be is depressed. The one thing that they refuse to be is unresilient. And one of my favorite movies is that beautiful John Borman film, not enough people know it, called Hope and Glory. It's an autobiographical film about his experiences in the London Blitz, in fact. And what makes the film so beautiful and sort of taboo-breaking is he had a wonderful time. He was 9 years old, and you couldn't... That's the nature of being nine, in fact, is that you simply have a certain kind of... There's a resilience of joy. So this book, which in a way is about parenting, but it's not about parenting what we teach our children. It's about what our children teach us, in fact. And it's about how their resilience emboldened me and gave me a certain kind of courage and a certain hope to go on. The very last line of the introduction is for me, I meant it to be a kind of sneaky epigraph for the entire book, and it's that shadows are all we have to show us the shapes that light can make. And I believe that's true. Without shadow, we don't see the shapes that light make, and I hope this book has both those shapes and those shadows.
And the last line of the book is actually uttered by your daughter, Olivia, who basically says, just trust me.
Yes, it's the reversal in the book, because one of the things I write about, and everybody who has children knows, is that half the time when you're a parent, you end up saying, just trust me. And whatever it is, how do we know we're safe? My son Luke, like all kids, worries a lot about tsunamis, about earthquakes, about, you know, how do we know there couldn't be a tsunami in New York? Well, it just has never been one. We're surrounded by water. How can there not be a tsunami? And you finally end up saying, just trust me, which really means in parentese, as every parent knows, not I know, but I'm a few steps ahead of you. I have this much more experience, and I just trust me that it hasn't happened yet, and I'm a little bit ahead of you. But inside, of course, every parent knows, you're thinking, I hope so. And especially when you're dealing with something like the shadow of terrorism, you know, you're saying, it's fine, just trust me. And inside you're thinking, should we be leaving? Should I, you know, what should we be doing? And I think until you're a parent yourself, it's not something you can learn, no matter how old you are when you become a parent, which is that for a child, even a grown child, the civilization of the family, it seems as ancient as Rome, that your family has always had its own little civilization, and it's always been there. And the parent knows that this little civilization in which the family lives is this wild thing of contingencies and chances and fragility. And you know what the mortgage is like, and you know how uncertain everything is, and yet the child can't experience it that way, and you can't let the child experience it that way. So finally, though, the beautiful and the ironic thing is in the end, your kids, when Olivia in the book was explaining to me why the title was terrible, she thought, Through the Children's Gate, it was an absolutely terrible title. No one will like it, Dad. No one will understand it. No one will know. You should call it The Silver Gate or something. And I said, oh, really? She said, yes, just trust me.
Besides your family, besides the kids and Martha, who obviously appear a lot in the book, the two people who reappear with some frequency in many of the essays are your sister, Allison, who is herself a developmental psychologist and who seems to, you know, have a direct line to you. The minute one of your kids has a weird dream or, you know, has a strange imaginary friend who is too busy to play with them, like Charlie Ravioli in one of the stories, she appears a lot and is doling out advice. And the other one is Kirk Varnadeau, who becomes his own kind of trajectory in the book. And when we meet him, he was first your teacher when you were studying art history. Then he becomes, you know, the very famous curator at the Museum of Modern Art and ends up sort of going off more into, what was it, the Institute at Princeton?
Advanced Studies.
Advanced Studies at Princeton. But we meet him as a cancer survivor early in the book. Then we find later on that he actually has had this cancer come back. And at the end, we're actually pretty much there when he's about to leave the world, but very much more present in your life in one of the essays, very specific one, Last of the Metrozoids. The choice to kind of include people in this and to decide these are the people who I want my readers to get to know, you know, must have been sort of fraught. You could have probably done that with a lot of different people in this book.
Yes, you know, it's a work of writing. And so, though it's everything in it is true and everything in it is as it happened, obviously the work of selection and stylization is very real. I had another very dear friend who died in the same time, who's not mentioned in the book at all, because I didn't want the book to become lugubrious. I didn't want it to be sort of a cycle of, oh God, this poor guy's friends are all dying. It's, you know, I didn't want to have that. So I left out a very significant, a hugely significant episode in my own life because I wanted the book to have one. One person. I know that sounds very cold-blooded when I say it. Like you think, I'll take you into the book and, you know, someone else will have to write your story. But it is the way writers have to work. It's a crafted thing. And even about the children, though, again, Bluey died and Charlie Ravioli was Olivia's imaginary friend, I take very specific chunks and pieces of our life, of their lives, and then I turn them into writing. So Charlie Ravioli, who was Olivia's imaginary friend when she was 3 and 4, who was always too busy to play with her. She would call him on her cell phone and say, are you there? Are you there? Then she'd hang up and say, I always get his machine. And she was the only imaginary friend. And then every once in a while, then she'd say, I bumped into Charlie Ravioli today. We had a cappuccino, but then he had to run. So we hopped in a taxi. And it was she had made it up out of New York experience. This
and then he has
friend.
An assistant.
Yeah, and then he
she
had
can't
an assistant,
even get through
Laurie.
To him anymore.
So, well, all of that was absolutely true. I didn't invent any of it. But it occupied this much space. You can't see it, but I'm just, you know, a tiny space in Olivia's life, which was more complicated. But it occupies a huge space in my written version, in the literary version of her life. Allison, my sister, is a brilliant developmental psychologist. And one of the things, and she really is, I mean, in the book, of course, she's a character because she's sort of always on call to give you a scientific explanation of everything that's baffling in life. Like, why would Olivia have an imaginary friend who's too busy to play with her? And she did say that didn't occur in the literature as she knew it. In fact, it was all New York. But also, I do feel a certain kinship. I feel an obvious kinship with her. She's my sister. But also an intellectual, deep intellectual kinship, because she makes her living and her vocation is watching children, observing them. She's a Piagetian psychologist. And it's sort of what I do, too. And in that way, I think that what I'm doing is some weird cross between Calvin Trillin and Piaget, in fact. You know, it's about writing funny stories about your kids, but also trying to observe them in a way that gives you general truths about childhood. I often feel it's so, though the book is about my children, I really believe it's about any children. If you gave me your children, I'd write the same things about them. What I'm interested in are not the incredibly cute and precocious things my kids do, though indeed they do many cute and precocious things. I'm interested in the ordinary things that children do. They have imaginary friends. They get traumatized when their fish die. They worry about disasters. And by beginning with those ordinary things that every child does and every child experiences, I try to navigate a kind of river towards common meanings. Kirk Varnedoe is the other, you're absolutely right, is the other. His life is a trajectory in his death, a trajectory in the book. And it was hugely important to me because, of course, I loved him and admired him. But also because his last years, and as you say, we thought he had survived and had a recurrence and knew he was going to die. His last 3 years were a study in courage at a time when we needed it terribly. As I say in the book, after 9/11, he was the one person I knew who was completely unrattled by it. Shocked, grief-stricken, appalled, but unrattled, refused to be afraid. And he said to me the day after, the Wednesday, September 12th, he said, we cannot allow this to deform, we cannot allow our fears to deform our lives in a way that diminishes the possibility of living. And he meant it personally. He meant, I'm dying. I've got two lungs. And he said to me, those two towers are my two lungs. I'm facing death anyway, but I am not going to allow my life to be defined by my fears. And he did that, as I explained in the book, for 3 years, in a way that would have been inspiring at any moment in life, but that in those circumstances and at that moment were particularly inspiring. And he went on, he refused to be heroic in a certain way, which is what made him heroic. He just wanted to live. And as I explained in the final story in the book, The Last of the Metrozoids, he took on the task of coaching my son Luke's 8-year-old flag football team with absolute seriousness, knowing that it would be the last year of his life, but he really wanted to do it. And week after week after week, he would teach these kids how to play football. And it was because, as I discovered, I couldn't understand it at first. I was delighted, but I couldn't see why he would devote that much time to it. It was something that was taking place in the present tense. It was something that was all about now. And that's what a great teacher does. He teaches you now. And at the same time, he was giving these brilliant lectures, which have just been published in Washington. So his example for me wasn't just a personal example, powerful though it was. It was, if you like, a civic example. It was an example of how do you deal with fear? How do you live your life in the face of fear? And the answer he gave us was, you don't. You simply refuse to be defined by your fears.
Well, we're being defined by this clock, unfortunately. We need to take a short break. So we're going to do that for about a minute. When we come back, we'll hear more from Adam Gopnik on his new book, Through the Children's Gate. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
On 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago. Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman is a series of conversations with noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space perfect for browsing. And the Newberry Library's bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456, toll-free, or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, November 19th, when Victoria Lautman talks with Sena Jeter Nasland about her book, Abundance, A Novel of Marie. If you would like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York, with its author, Adam Gopnik.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to remind you that, you know, this is a free series. If people are listening on the radio, that's great. You can also come down to Looking Glass and be part of the broadcast audience, which is really a lot of fun. Coming up in the next few months of Writers on the Record, we have next month, November 19th, Sena Jeter Nasland, who wrote Ahab's Wife, has just is publishing a new book called Abundance, a novel of Marie Antoinette, who definitely seems to be the lady of the hour. And then we have a little break in December. And in January, we have Martin Amis coming up, Anchee Min, Alice Hoffman, Arthur Phillips. It's really a great season. So make sure you keep tuning in and coming to this. But my guest today is Adam Gopnik, and his new book is Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York. And like Paris to the Moon from almost exactly 6 years ago, the book is structured in a really interesting way because half of it is comprised of essays that were previously published, but really fully almost a complete half of the book is newly written material. In Paris to the Moon, those were your Christmas kind of
Christmas
sections,
letters, right.
Christmas letters, very diary-like and, you know, kept us sort of up to date. It's like a matrix, and you do the same thing in this, only it's Thanksgiving. And there's, I don't know, like there's five of them.
Five Thanksgivings in the book. And in Paris to the Moon, I wanted to use the device of letters home every Christmas because it seemed like a time when you would take a break, and Christmas seems like a very Parisian occasion. In this book, I wrote five Thanksgivings, which are sort of journals. They take the form of that. But what I really wanted to do, I chose Thanksgiving because Thanksgiving, I think, is the great New York holiday. It's a totally secular feast. It's got those giant balloons. And for 4 days, we pretend to be country people, and we roast a turkey, and we have friends over and so on. But also what I wanted to do in these Thanksgivings, in Paris the Moon, the Christmas letters were sort of like the kind of little pensive exhalations at the end of all of the energy of each year. And in this case, I had lots of little riffs, frankly, lying around, little things that had happened. And in the kind of work I do, the kind of essays I write, you have to have a riff about something that's funny that's happened to you that you can tell to people. And then you have to make a left turn into traffic and see where that funny riff connects to a larger idea. People sometimes think that the comic essay, the personal essay, is a self-indulgent form. But in my experience, it's the least self-indulgent of forms because it's the one where you have to signal the reader very, very rapidly that it's not about the dead goldfish. It's not about an imaginary friend. It's actually attached to some larger idea. In a novel, you can go on for chapters, you know, having your characters get dressed and undressed and before you know what the drama is. But you can't do that in an essay. But sometimes I would have these riffs, and they wouldn't attach to a larger idea right away. But then what I realized is that if I put them into a kind of contrapuntal riffdom, one against another, then I could really end up with a nice structure so that in the first one, for instance, I talk about how everyone in New York fights about noise, about when our neighbors were complaining about the noise we were making. And at the same time, in my son's progressive school, they were trying to get the children to fly because they were doing a version of Peter Pan. And all of these hyper-ambitious parents were trying to find techniques that the kids could fly in without alarming the lawyer parents, in fact, about liability issues. And so so what I was trying to do is bring those things. And finally, of course, the neighbors complaining about the noise and the children flying above work together in some way. So I was trying to do that in all of these Thanksgivings.
Well, the self-indulgent aspect, I don't know. That's going to come into play with the one you're about to
well,
to read.
The one I'm about to read was something that really happened. I wanted to write, but there again, there's nothing worse than a writer who's constantly pointing to his symbols and explaining the brilliant engineering of his work. But I did want to write about, and this is a third Thanksgiving. This is the third year. It's called Bitterosities because Olivia's imaginary friend Charlie Ravioli's wife died suddenly of a strange disease, as she explained to us at lunch, called bitterosity. And I realized everybody I know in New York is suffering from bitterosity of more or less acute form. And our whole goal is not to die from it. But I also wanted to write about the new homeland security culture, both in its very serious form, which was all around us, and also my own little experience with it. Because what happened is I had to do a turn as a security guard for the kids' school, in fact. And I had to wear an orange vest and carry a walkie-talkie and make sure that all the children got home safely without Al-Qaeda or muggers laying their hands on them, in fact. And I got very cold doing it. I learned why cops are the way they are. You know, first of all, you become paranoid as you walk around and around the same block because you spot all these little patterns. But you also get cold, so you want caffeine and a donut. So as I made my rounds, I began to eye wistfully a busy Starbucks in the corner of 87th Street, full of laughing people knocking back hot drinks. The craving began to work on me so strongly that after a solid, virtuous hour of safety patrol, I decided to stop for a quick, excusable, union-sanctioned break. The union would have blessed it had they known about it, and had I belonged to one. I ducked into the Starbucks, leaving my poor private school charges, I suppose, for a moment completely naked to the Hobbesian elements, and got in line. Just a quick triple grande cappuccino and a biscotti, I swore, and I would be back outside, keeping the peace. I got in line. The guy in front of me, a white guy in a suit with a loosened tie, was ordering one of those Baroque flavored and sweetened seasonal drinks that Starbucks sells, an eggnog latte or a gingerbread cappuccino, that kind of thing. There was some kind of confusion on the part of the girl behind the register. Did he want a tall or a grande or a calf or a decaf? And he sighed hard and said, "What is wrong with you?" He had a nasty, bad New York tone. "Hey," I said, about as sternly as I have ever said anything to anyone, "let's keep it polite here." He swiveled and saw me standing there, an obnoxious shrimp, and was about to start letting me have it. But I held up my walkie-talkie and hit the button, surprising him with a blast of static. And then I stood there, impassive. He took me in. My orange vest, my electronic communications gear, my look of official purpose. Perhaps the fuzz. Obviously the fuzz. Although whether bona fide a Starbucks security or a sinister private contractor, he was as yet uncertain. He took one nanostep back, unsure. I scowled and hit him with another burst of static. Then I spoke into the radio. "It's all right," I said to no one in particular. "This situation's secure." It sounded, I thought, just like what Starbucks security might be reporting back to Seattle. Then I looked at him again hard. The hiss and cough of the milk steamers continued in the background. He shrugged and stepped to the back counter where you pick up your drink. I hit the back of his jacket hard with one last long-distance burst of meaningless electric noise. I felt utterly vindicated, in love with the booming security professions, at home in the new epoch, a lover of my time, administering homeland safety, proud and paranoid among the paper cups.
Oh, hilarious. Adam Gopnik reading from Through the Children's Gate. And, you know, those sections, they're such interesting moments because they can encompass anything. And they kind of like ricochet around and you will tell a personal story, but you'll take it into some historical thing. And I just wonder, like how much work are those for you? I mean, you make it seem effortless.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I hope that the fun of them should be that when you get to the end, that there's like five vectors coming in at once. And when you come to the end, it turns out to be one singularity, one common point that all of these different things, some little reporting riffs, some personal riffs, some very serious riffs, all move in one direction. And so if it works, then at the end it should be like a fugue. You say, oh, my God, there are five themes playing at once, and they all are in the same rhythm and the same key.
Yeah, but does it ever just screw up for you? And you're like,
sure.
Wait, there's some wayward...
And then you do it again, and you do it over again, and you do it over again. I like very written books. You know, I realize that about myself. I like written things, and I like to write in that way. And it just takes time and work and an editor to make it happen.
It made me wonder in reading these, because it really seems as though anything, if somebody said, you know, write about this pen, that you would be able to take that and do what you've told us is your pattern. You take the idea of the pen, you go back to the history of writing, to the first, you know, cave dweller, then you bring in Kant or Freud, you know, you make this context for
you,
and then you...
The thing is, Victoria, is I that is sort of what I do. And somebody once said, very flatteringly, you could see the world in a grain of sand. And I'm also conscious of the fact that there's something to be said against guys who are staring at grains of sand while this vast waves are pouring over the heads of everybody else on the beach. A writer can't become a prisoner of his method. And I'm always conscious of the fact that, though that's what I do, that it could very quickly become shtick, in fact. And I have to be very conscious of that. And in this book, I wanted it to have a kind of emotional candor and directness that I hope the previous book had as well, but I'm trying to move in that direction. I don't want, and I'm conscious of the fact that my writing's been short on appetite, passion, sexual passion, descriptions of those things. So, you know, if you're a miniaturist, you have to keep your eye on the maximal or you'll become merely a Stickmeister of the small.
Okay, no, I wasn't going to bring up sex in this book because there really isn't any,
right. Except
that there's a lot of references to sex when you read the book, as intensely as I did from beginning to end. There's a kind of like, if you read between the lines, there's you talk about, you know, terror sex and how you missed out on it because you were married and you had kids. And then you talk about having to, at like five essays later, about having to make a once a month sex date,
right.
You know. And there actually is a lot of sex in the book.
There's a lot of frustrated sex in the book.
Yeah.
Because that's when you go through the children's gate, that's what your life becomes. We used to joke and say for the first 15 years of our marriage, we always worried about the consequences of sex. And then we had children after that. And then for the next 15 years of our marriage, we've always worried about the consequences of sex in a different way. And I think it's true. One of the facts about being obsessive parents is that suddenly your libido doesn't drop away, but your opportunities to practice it vanish before your eyes. So if you have the sense of a desperately frustrated husband as well as a very happy father, I think that's an accurate reading of the subtext of the book, in fact.
Oh, good. Okay, just wanted to be sure. This would be a good time. If anybody is interested in asking questions, please make your way. We'd love to have questions to either of the two microphones.
But, you know, it's funny, because that is something. In Paris, the Moon, my favorite thing that I've ever written, which is, I think, no one else's favorite, was a story called Angels Dining at the Ritz in Paris to the Moon, where I was trying to write about exactly that. I was trying to write about married love and married desire, But rather than trying to write on the nose about it, I wrote about my son, about Luke's first love affair with a beautiful 5-year-old girl. He was 5 at the time, named her real name was Victoria. I called her Cassandra. And so I do try. I hope that you have a sense of that, of the in the book, that it's not neutered completely, but that it's sublimated into the writer's plaintive cries of longing, rather than in you know, wild Updikean descriptions of revelry.
I'm not sure if that's what I felt. I want to take a detour now away from your libido and sex life and into just
Please,
your...
Please, let's do that, too.
Her lack
so
thereof.
So does my wife, an old Groucho Marx joke.
Into just your history at The New Yorker. I mean, you've been there for 20 years. That was, what, 4 regimes
I've,
that you've
yes,
weathered?
I've worked for 4 different editors-in-chief. I've been very blessed, though, because I've worked with 4 editors, I've really only worked with 2 direct literary editors, Charles McGrath, Chip McGrath, who then went on to become the editor of the Times Book Review, who really taught me how to write, basically stripped all the adjectives and adverbs out of my writing and told me the most important thing I've ever known about writing, which is that you write with ands, not with buts. That is, you can make an argument in an academic paper by saying, so-and-so says this, but when you're writing, doing real writing, you say, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then a narrative begins to produce, which is infinitely more persuasive than buffeting the reader back and forth across the ring. And then for the last 10 years, I've been edited by a brilliant editor named Henry Finder, who is in the joy of having a really wonderful editor, and Henry's let me put all those adjectives and adverbs back in the work. And the joy of working with a really good editor is that you can show them rough work. You can say, I know there's an idea in here someplace. I'm confident that there is, but I'm not sure where it is yet. And it's very hard for writers to do that because you know how bad your work is. And you say, I don't want to show it to anyone. But if you have somebody you can trust that way, you've been through the wars with, they can say, this bit is good. The other bits are terrible, but I think you're onto something here. So I've been very blessed that way.
In just seeing that particular 20 years at The New Yorker, sort of separate from yourself and what you were doing, but just that was a very rocky period, and I don't know.
See, I was trying to evade this subject.
Forget
story,
it,
and
dude.
I didn't quite do it. Yes, it's been an eventful 20 years that I've been at The New Yorker. We've been through many changes, and physical and emotional and so on. It's hard for me to talk about it, of course, because if I praise the current regime, you know, I'm like an Eastern European writer before the fall of the wall. What am I going to say? I do think, and I say this truly, that through all of the complicated ups and downs of those years, we have miraculously, and through the brilliant work of David Remnick, we have now come to a wonderful plateau. I don't think the magazine's certainly never been better in my time there, and we've never had more readers. And I think, if I may be allowed to be patriotically hype it for a moment, that we perform a function now that in a way is more valuable than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago, because there are far fewer places that do the kind of thing we do. And I see people on the subway reading it, and I see people around reading it, and at a time when the whole of our discourse in the United States seemed to have broken down into these tiny machine gun bursts of opinion and attitude, The New Yorker is one of the few places where there is the possibility of long-form argument and metaphor. And I think that we've taken a turn towards the news in lots of ways in the last 5 years, and I think that's been a very wise thing for us to do. But I hope we always remain a place where argument and metaphor live in a world, as I say, of attitude and opinion.
At some point, I guess I read that you, at age 8, decided you wanted to live in Paris. And then from what you read, it was very clear that you also had your heart set on New York. And you managed to live in both those places and write about them in this really kind of, you know, magical way that you were allowed to do and turn them into books, which is, you know, extends the magic even further. And now I'm thinking, well, what else was in? Is there Cleveland? Is there Los Angeles? Have you done the places that you want to live? Have you done that form? And where are you going next? I know you had worked on a novel at one point.
I'm working on a novel still. I've been working on it for a few years now. I'd like to write another children's book. I even have a title for it. I would like to, you know, I don't, it's funny because sometimes Paris the Moon got, I would see it in bookstores under travel literature. And it would make me laugh, a bitter and hollow laugh, because I am the world's worst traveler. You know, there are guys like the great Bruce Chatwin or something who love going to strange places. I don't know how to drive. I have very flat feet. and I get car sick in any conveyance. And I don't like going places. I like being places. And the places I loved, New York and Paris, I'd be fascinated to live in Los Angeles and write about it, because Los Angeles always seems to me like Mars. It's a civilization off to itself, in fact. That would be interesting. But really, I think that the writing I want to do for the next, 20 years or whatever I'm given to do is I'd like to take another turn, left turn into traffic, which I think every writer ought to do all the time. I'd like to write about all of those appetites and passions which are merely subliminated in my work right now. I'd like to write better, more simply, differently. So I think I don't think I'd write about the children or about raising children again. I think I've sort of done that now. I'd like to be a better writer than I am.
We have somebody about to ask a question here. Thank you. Go right ahead.
No problem. I suppose that as a memoirist, you've probably talked about this a lot in the past year, but when you were talking about your selection process in terms of characters that you incorporated in your book, it brought to mind the whole James Fry incident and, all of the fallout about the mm-hmm. sort of genre of memoir and what that means. And for a couple of weeks after the revelations came out, there seemed to be it seemed as though there might be a productive discussion about the literary theory and the definition right. of it until the big flang on Oprah. And then it was just James Fry is pariah.
I think
and no
every
one's
writer
to talk about him.
In the middle of the night sees James Fry sitting there with his life passing before his eyes and thinks, there but for the grace of Oprah go I. In
right.
fact,
well,
but
I was just
let me talk
about
you. Sure,
process.
I thought about it a lot. I feel for that poor guy, because if ever there was a book which sort of says on it, this book is bull, it's that book. And then if you read it, you say, this book is bull. And he sort of admits it. And then everybody says, but you've written a book that's all bull. Every memoir, I like to write out of truth because that's the fun of it. But if everything in this book is true, but everything is selected, it's a literary artifact that stands to one side of the full stream of my experience, children's experience, whatever else. Many, as we know, of the best memoirs that have ever been written. Chateaubriand's great memoir, in fact, where he claims to have come to America and had an intimate relationship with General Washington or President Washington, never happened at all. Does that make Chateaubriand a less interesting writer? Of course not. I think that there's a kind of willingness to apply to make everything or to have everything be tested by a very narrow standard of verisimilitude. I think that every good writer knows that there are different moments when different standards apply. When you're writing a funny story, everybody understands that there are principles of selection that go into it. You want it to be a true story, but it's a funny story. When you're writing about D-Day, you want it to be precise in a pointillist way, and you try to signal your readers, this is really exactly in every detail what happened. A.J. Liebling, the great writer, is a genius at this. Some of his pieces, like the stories about Colonel Stingo, his low-life friend, you can tell are sort of tall tales. When he goes on D-Day, that's the way it happened. That's what happened. And so I think that there can't be many standards of truth, but there are varying standards of style, and there's an engagement between the writer and reader that has it go on. Literature is a risky thing. Reading is, you do not for information, you do it for meaning. And meaning's a more complicated thing. And like you, I was very sad to see that whole very complicated and subtle and delicate argument dragged down to the lowest level of are you a liar or not? If that's a
thank
that's
you.
An answer. And like everybody, as like every writer, as I say, I see myself on stage with Oprah at 3:45 in the morning at that club. Thank God. At least that hasn't happened yet. But I'm on stage with you, Victoria. And
that's right. It's the next best thing.
You're about to pull a legal brief.
Right.
There was no fish. There was no imaginary friend.
Right.
There was
Bluey
no
Bluey was actually
there
named Gray.
No what can I... you got me. I'm sorry. What can I say?
I promise I'm not going to go check you out, whether you actually were wearing an orange, vest. And anyway, I did read something that I thought was very charming that you did recently, and that was... I did a lot of research, so I'm not going to bring up the fact that you were on the most loathsome New York New Yorker list last year, being called a flaneur fob, which actually was a great, you know, most people don't even have never heard of flaneur. But I did think it was interesting that you wrote a fan letter to another writer, and the writer was Daniel Handler.
Yes, that's
who,
true.
As Lemony Snicket, that's you true. Read Lemony Snicket and thought, this is great, and took it upon yourself to write a fan letter to this guy. And then you became friends and actually participated in a discussion together in San Francisco. And I thought, you know, that's really great. Most writers, particularly somebody like you who's doing the kind of work that you're doing, would not take it upon themselves either to read Lemony Snicket, which you obviously were doing to your kids, but deciding, this is great, I want to know more about this guy.
I've always felt terrific. I think that whenever any writer gets a letter from anybody, you're incredibly grateful. You know, most of my readers, as my son always points out to me, are usually pushing 85, in fact. He always threatens to bring a defibrillator to my readings, in fact. But so when you get a letter from anybody, you're delighted. When you get a letter from another writer, it's particularly good. So I guess it's sort of like a bit of a George Bush Sr. thing to do, you know, writing. But Daniel's book was wonderful, and I like to appreciate other people's work.
Who else have you written to lately?
I just wrote a letter yesterday. Shows you how much time I have in my hands on right now. There was a kid I never heard of who had a wonderful piece about Weird Al Yankovic in Slate. And I thought, wow, somebody has really written the Weird Al Yankovic piece that I had been meaning to write all these years. Seriously, so Weird Al Yankovic is an unappreciated American satirist and insufficiently appreciated. So I wrote to him. And now, to be honest, I'm a little bit, because I've been around for so long now, I'm a little bit in the sort of senior position, right, of, you know, where you say, oh, my goodness, this guy is writing to me, you know. It's sort of, and it's, as I felt when I was younger, you know, that if you got, I got a letter from Updike when I was starting out, and I thought, okay, maybe I can do this then, you know, all that too. Actually, Updike gave me the best piece of advice, and I hardly know him, I've, you know, met him three times, but he gave me the best piece of advice I ever got about writing. He said, either you're a no writer or you're a yes writer, and if you're a yes writer, just do everything that you can, and don't waste emotional energy worrying about what you're going to write next. Just write the next thing, and I've always thought that that spares you a lot of the worrying that no writers do about not writing, about what you should write next. You just write.
I have one last question before we go, and it's not even necessarily a good question, but I'm curious. And that is that when you brought your family back from Paris to New York, and that was what you wanted to do, to bring your kids, to raise them as New Yorkers, just as the way you wanted to go and experience Paris, if 9/11 happened before you had made that decision, would that have altered it for you?
It's a very good question. Probably. I guess, you know, we might have been repelled by fear or something. But, you know, it didn't. And we live the life that we're given. And I think that in a weird way, though I'm not immune to all the fears that fill all of our lives and imaginations, having lived through that, having seen the city as resilient as it was, having seen millions of people in New York faced with a choice, deciding that they would choose their lives over their fears, and having chosen their lives over their fears, having chosen their hopes over their fears, because you can't live without hope. I think that's an incredibly moving and beautiful thing, and though the book is not meant to be a polemic, it's a comedy of manners, I hope underneath it you see in miniature the process by which people refuse to live in fear. And that, for me, at this moment in American history, is the most valuable thing we can have. A great man once said, be not afraid. And smaller men refuse to say that.
We're going to end on that note. And Adam Gopnik, thank you so much for joining us on Writers on the Record.
I've loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
The people at the Maven Chronicles and at the Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which will return on Sunday, November 19th, when Victoria's guest will be Sina Jeter-Nasland, author of Abundance, a novel of Marie. If you would like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft, House Sound Bob Gilmartin, Director of Production Alex Blunt, and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunis is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Today's broadcast was made possible in part by the Maven Chronicles and by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. You're tuned to 98.7 WFMT Chicago, a service of Network Chicago.